Tonight's title is Care of the Earth, Holden's Struggles and Ours. And it's a forum. We've invited six people to say brief remarks about some aspect of the struggle to be good stewards of creation here in Holden, some of the exciting things that have been happening. They're going to keep their remarks pretty short so that the bulk of the time can be spent tonight talking about the issues in our lives. Not so much here at the village, but out in the world, ways that we can start working on some of these issues in our cities and towns and wherever we live. But we are going to begin by focusing on Holden, since this is where we live, and plus I think some really exciting things are happening now at Holden in terms of this issue. A lot has been done, a lot yet to be done. So the people who are going to be talking are Sharon on food. She's one of our cooks. Chris Borges, who's our mechanic, but also has written a scathing letter about packaging and has some feelings about that. Kirk is going to be talking about sort of miscellaneous conservation here as far as driving and energy conservation in our buildings. We've been doing a lot of work on that this year. Steve is going to talk about garbage. Joanna's going to talk about recycling. And Barry is going to talk about low impact on the wilderness in terms of hiking and camping, only other stuff too. I didn't pick out an order. Let's begin with Sharon and food.
All right. Well, I think to talk about how the food service department uses its resources, I kind of broke it down into just three basic areas. There's the purchasing of food and what we try to do around that, and then the serving and preparing of food and the ways we try to address that, and then the storing and handling of food and what we would do with food that is wasted or can no longer be eaten. So I'll just kind of break those up. For the purchasing of food, first of all, what we try to do is we try to order bulk and natural foods. So foods is as much as we can in bulk and food that is in its most natural state as possible. In other words, we try to stay away from refined food and heavily processed food or highly packaged food. A lot of the little individual kinds of things, like little small individual juice things, we try to really stay away from that. We try to buy things in bulk. We try to order from distributors who promote natural foods also, and distributors who are into possibly supporting organic farming and organic food production, moving away from pesticides and the things that most common grocery store and restaurant distributors will contribute to. So we try to move away from that, and we try to order from distributors who promote natural and health foods. And then we try to avoid contributing to the profit-making aspect of food production. We've just recently made a change in our kitchen going to bulk cereals, and we found that in a lot of ways, you know, cereal is such a commercial example, an example of the way that our food production in this country has become a commercial profit-making kind of thing. You take a box of Wheaties, and really only a small percentage of what you pay for that box of Wheaties is actually the cereal. The nutritional content might even be changed because it has been you know, refined and processed in different ways. And then you pay quite a bit for the box itself and for the advertising on the box. And a lot of what I have come to find in my food studies work is that by contributing to a profit-making industry, it actually reduces the amount of food that is available for all of us, especially low-income people. Low-income people can't pay for that kind of advertising. And actually the gift of food, which is free from God for all of us, for our life sustenance, becomes actually a money-making profit kind of market that actually excludes some people from being able to receive the basic sustenance of life. So we try to avoid contributing to that kind of profit-making mentality on food and sticking more to basic foods that can kind of help allow for many people to eat and not just the rich. The second area then, with serving and preparing food, we try to prepare food that is nutritious and delicious, is what I like to call it, and also low on the food chain. So it's nutritious in trying to provide the body definitely all the nutrients that are needed without all the extra fat, all the extra preservatives, all the extra cholesterols, and things that you'll find in a lot of just average American processed food. So it's nutritious and delicious Delicious for a lot of people in new ways. It's not necessarily the most typical food that you'll eat. We try to provide food that is low on the food chain, which just means basically that if we look at the levels of how sophisticated food can become, we find that animal fleshes are actually the most sophisticated forms of protein because they take a lot of grain to feed the animals, and then the animal is slaughtered for human consumption. And there's a lot of waste in that process, where if the humans directly eat grains and they eat some of the basic things that come right from the earth, there is very minimal waste in that. So there's a whole study of what we call the food chain, and we try to eat lower on the food chain here at Holden. We try to serve food that is fresh. We try to avoid canned products and processed foods, as I said. Even things like our cheese is natural cheese, and we try to really cut down on canned goods because they produce a lot of waste too. Tin cans has been something that we have to deal with up here at Holden. We also try to prepare balanced meals without much emphasis on meat in our diet, without much meat being consumed or animal flesh of any type. We try to find alternative proteins that are both less expensive and better for our body. And then lastly, we have the storing and handling of food. And how we try to address that is we try to, first of all, avoid food waste by preparing just enough for what is needed for the people in the diet, in the village, for the amount of people at any given time. And not such a small amount that people are going to walk away hungry, but definitely not a real lot so that we have a lot of leftover food, because it's hard to deal with leftover food then. We try to also do that by in our process of serving the food, to avoid waste. We try to fill up boats, and for example, the tureens and the dish platters that come back to the kitchen for more food, we try to fill them up with just an amount that possibly the people at the table would be able to finish completely. And if they even want more, we invite them to come back for more, but we continue to fill it up only enough that all the food that goes out to the tables will hopefully be consumed, because that food is very hard to reuse. We can only reuse that once. Whereas if food has not gone out to the tables, but it still is left over and it has remained in the kitchen, it's more easily reusable because it has not been contaminated by being in the hands of many. So that's one way that we try to also deal with avoiding food waste. And then we also save leftover food, and if it's leftover food that can be eaten directly again in another dish, we can only serve that once. So we then try to prepare dishes that we will be able to serve again. If it's food that is like leftover cereal or things that are a little bit hard to warm back up again and serve a second time, we try to put those in making bread. We put those in some of the other things that we'll bake as far as casseroles go, or bakery, that we can use that in making the dough, for example, for bread or pastry. So then we try to use leftover food that way. We use all of our leftover vegetables, vegetable ends for making vegetable broth for the soups that we make, so we don't waste any of that. And then we do handle food waste that does need to be thrown then by composting it. And even though we don't have the facilities to use it directly on a garden or something, at least we return it back to the earth already somewhat decomposed and already kind of broken down in a pretty significant way before we return it back to the earth. So, I guess I'll just leave it with that. We definitely have some problems of not being able to always address the system of finding the most economical ways for the earth, but we continue to try to make efforts in that direction.
Thanks. Let's just follow that food right on down after it's thrown away the leftovers in here. Next from Steve Kramer, herbologist.
I've been the garbologist since Friday, so I'm really not at all an expert on the garbology process here. We have three major ways to things to do with garbage at Holden. All we can really do with it is bury it, burn it, or recycle it, which is sort of the options you have on the outside too. It's probably about all the options we have. And so all our efforts are towards responsible disposal of stuff by those three methods. And so we take, like Sharon said, the food scraps are all composted in a compost system that Russ Wold is, he's here, not over here, not yet. But yeah, he actually started, understand, the whole thing. And Sharon said that that's what that is either spreading the tailings to try to hold down the tailings to try to grow stuff, or she's using the lawns and flower beds and stuff. And then all the paper and burnable things like paper and cardboard in the past have been burned in an incinerator on the second level. We are sort of toying with the idea of trying to recycle the paper and cardboard also, but it's a lot of logistic hurdles to overcome in that thing. But hopefully we'll be doing that within a couple of months. We'll be able to recycle, ship the paper and cardboard out. The tin cans and scrap metal like that kind of thing we recycle now. Glass is sorted and recycled. And like aluminum, obviously, is something like that's real, some obvious stuff we also recycle. The stuff that's left, which includes stuff like plastic bags, which majority of things are probably plastic bags, styrofoam packaging, which is, you're amazed how much of that stuff we have up here. Stuff that gets shipped in styrofoam packaging. And stuff like plastic buckets or shampoo containers, things like that, are all buried in the tailings, the landfill up there. And we could burn those, I guess. Some people suggested trying to burn those plastics, but they produce a lot of toxic fumes, toxic gases, which for this valley probably wouldn't be concentrated enough to really cause problems. But as an example for the world, it's a pretty terrible example to burn plastics and stuff like that. So we don't want to do that for that reason, nothing else. We've started the last 3 weeks, we've been using garbology team. Rich Anderson had an idea to, I guess some other people had the idea too, to get the whole staff involved in garbology. So we've been, the whole village is garbologists, all the staff in the village have been the garbologists for the past 3 weeks. And they collect and sort and compost and bury and burn the garbage, which is, I think, a really good idea, a really good thing to have happen, because you really see what all's being done. For me, it was really enlightening, I guess, to be involved in the sorting of stuff, because it's really amazing the amount of stuff, even up here at Holden, we produce, you know, it's kind of incredible.
Steve, how long does it take a bleach ball to decompose about?
I don't think bleach bottles ever decompose as far as practical. I think the human race would be long gone if bleach bottle decomposes.
Bleach bottles?
Yeah.
Like that? They're almost plastic?
They're almost inert, yeah. Those things are.
Well, I've seen them like up on the third level, and there's one by the CERN, and they shatter. So something's happening. I mean, they're real brittle after several years. Real brittle if they're out in the sun.
Yeah, ultraviolet rays decompose plastic somewhat. So if it's in the sun, it could decompose it. Even decomposing plastic in the sun even gives off fumes, like styrofoam things on the side of the road. A lot of times you find, if you pick up litter on the side of the road, like a styrofoam container, it just practically dissolves. But even when they dissolve in ultraviolet rays, like from the sun, it's that UV rays, even when they dissolve like that, they produce a lot of toxic gases. Like dioxin is a real big one that plastics produce when they're burnt or decomposed that way. And so dioxin is pretty, people know what dioxin is, it's pretty potent poison. So plastics are real, plastics are a thing we're trying to have a war on plastics. It's kind of what, one of the things we're trying to do at Holden, kind of, there's been a lot of energy towards that for the last month and a half, I guess. We kind of started this whole garbology teams and started a lot of good energy at Holden Village. It was a cleanup day we had on the tailings. And we picked up all the trash that had blown out of the landfill. From either being poorly buried or just had surfaced because the wind had blown off tailings. It was just an incredible day, incredible morning spent picking up garbage, and there's a lot of energy. Really, it turned out to be really good day, because a lot of energy got tapped and we got a lot of good stuff. A lot of anger, yeah. It was really incredible. I mean, we just several truckloads of garbage out of the creek, out of Copper Creek, and off the tailings in the art show field. It was just an incredible day, and that's kind of where I would say that's probably the start of the whole. Garbology teams and a lot of the recycling efforts came out of that day, just the energy from that day.
Joanne, why don't you say a word about recycling here?
Steve talked about the tin and the glass that we're recycling on a daily basis. The other project that we started mainly as Steve said after that day of, I guess, anger, is cleaning up the third level. The third level of the tailings is the upper level where a lot of the heavy garbage has been dumped over the years from the village. It's been basically, I think, put up there as being out of sight, out of mind, but it's, there's been a commitment at this point to move that all out of here. And practically speaking, what that has meant is that the village has budgeted some money to do that. And also, given our locations, a lot of connections have had to be made. And how to get it out of here, you can't just drive it down to the recycling center. So what that involves is contracting with the Chelan Boat Company, the barge that makes a run up here every week, bringing us stuff. They've agreed to take shipments of things out, and that's what we're doing today is getting things together to have them shipped out. And from that point, making connections to have it picked up and then brought to the appropriate places for recycling. I think Steve and Kent have been doing a lot of background for all that.
And there's two truckfuls of it. For those of you who didn't get up to the third level, you can see them on the volleyball court. Some of the stuff that's going on. Barry, you want to talk about?
While we're making efforts to conserve the resources that we do use in the village, we're also really concerned about conserving the environment and the resources outside of the village. Because we are literally surrounded at Holden by a designated wilderness area, which is the most restricted land in the United States, essentially. And the only reason why we're not wilderness area here is because Holden was already here. So there's literally, if you look at a map, there's literally a little circle that comes up the road and around Holden and goes back that's in the middle of a wilderness area. Most of the people who come to Holden are people who are very well intentioned, who are really do care about the earth, but frankly a lot of the people who come don't have that much experience hiking or being out in the mountains, and are not, even with very good intentions, are not really aware of the way in which little tiny impacts on the ground and trees and trails around here multiply and multiply as more and more people use them. We usually have about 400 and something people in this village in the summer. There are very few places in the United States where you have that many people plopped down in the middle of an area this remote. And the impact on this area is really quite tremendous. So we really try to make a very concerted effort in educating people who come here to hike. And we do that with in several ways. We have information in the Hike House that's available written form. We also really try to make an effort to have enough staff in the Hike House to be able to talk to people who come in and ask for information and make sure that, and even ask them if they're aware of some of those things and give them some information on it. We also at least once a week have a session on no trace or camping and hiking or wilderness ethics. It includes about a 20-minute slideshow that the Forest Service does and then discussing specifics of this area. And really just pointing out to people how just staying on the trail can make a real difference, and not, if you're going to be off the trail, ways of walking off the trail that will make less of an impact, and what you do when you camp. And you know, there are people that still sort of live by the Boy Scout manual of 1960s where you trench your tents and things like that, and that is really not used anymore because of the environmental impact, because of the huge increase in numbers of people who hike now than there was, say, 15 or 20 years ago. So I think the final thing, which maybe is the most important, is by really encouraging staff to be models of that. We just used a good half of our community meeting a couple of weeks ago to look at that whole issue and show the slideshow and really ask staff to take that seriously and to sort of serve in a model capacity for both guests and other staff that come in during the summer. And we work with the Forest Service on a lot of that too. I think that's probably all I need to say for now.
I'll just add that Barry got an award from the Forest Service last summer for his role in promoting that at Holden, and it really has been good to see that kind of emphasis here. One of the brochures you talked about, Without a Trace, is in this brochure rack here too, if you want to pick up a copy of that, see some of what they suggest. Kirk, on conservation in the village and on the roads.
I had them. I guess one of the nice things about Holden is the people you get to work with. And I've had the privilege to work with some people this winter who have had a real sound conservation ethic. And talk about two areas that I was able to be involved with this winter. And one was with Chris, when winter started, I took over the head driving responsibilities, which just basically is scheduling drivers and whatnot. And we run snow vehicles during the winter that are very high maintenance items. They don't put on a whole lot of miles before something tends to go wrong. Not by anybody's fault, it's just the nature of the beast. And we also then try to plow when we have to maintain the road and plowing the road, keeping the road open for buses early in the season, and then giving up on the road because of snow. And we give it back to nature and let her do whatever she will with the road. We ran Bombardier's longer this year than we did in the years past, and I guess Chris would probably know this on the top of his head. We started running Bombardier's in the middle of December, and we weren't able to stop until middle of April. And as compared to last year, when we didn't run Bombardiers as long, we put on fewer miles, used less gas, and it was basically because of a very concerted effort on our parts to be very conservative about driving and about when we took trips down the road. There were very few times where we ever went down the road just to go do something, such as plow or go fix something. We always tried to combine our trips. I think the drivers hated me. I think I sounded ridiculous most of the winter, but it paid off. It paid off in many ways, not only in the lower mileage. But also, I think we had more driver care for the vehicles. We really didn't have anybody make a driver error. I mean, most repairs here are made because somebody screwed up. They didn't see something. They weren't listening. They weren't watching. They weren't being careful. We really didn't have that this winter. And that's a real tribute to our drivers that we had this winter. We hope to keep that going in the summer. It's harder to control in the summer because there are more vehicles and more people driving. I'll come back to that point in just a moment. The other thing I had an opportunity to work with this summer is, unfortunately, the visible aspects of the project is gone, but I was working a little bit with some of the heating systems here and saw that we have a wood-fired boiler in Chalet 1 that's quite a bit larger than it can make a lot more hot water than they could ever use in Chalet 1. They could have basically opened their windows and we could still keep them about 75 degrees, I'm sure. There's no doubt in my mind. It's really oversized. We decided we'd run some pipes from the boiler in Chalet 1 up to Chalet 3, which is heated by diesel, as most of the chalets are. And we'd put a circulating pump on there, and we'd actually have the water heated down in Chalet 1, run it about 120 feet up into Chalet 3, and then have it go through the, the radiators in Chalet 3 and back down to Chalet 1 to have it reheated again. I've never done anything with heating before, and got this idea and kind of figured it would cost us, I don't know, I think I said $500. And I said we could pay it back if it worked, but I didn't know if it'd work. I called a couple people.
You did a lot of the rest of us.
I called a couple people in Seattle. They assured me it worked, but you know, who was I? I certainly didn't know. So we finally got the thing hooked up in January, and at the last moment, I was starting to get nervous. I'll admit that folks started calling it the Chalet 3 refrigeration project. I didn't know if it'd pull water up the hill, but it did, and it worked. It worked. And I spent more than $500. I probably spent about probably close to $900 for the pipe and pumps. But I think we saved about $650 in the short time that we ran it. And we can reuse all these pipes. And what we plan to do this summer then, we're building a small building to house the boiler behind Chalet 1 for fire safety reasons, and then we're going to lay the pipe underground this summer, and we're probably going to extend it into Chalet 4, 5, and 6, knowing that it won't be able to heat it in the colder days, but on our more temperate days, it probably will be able to heat all those buildings, and all those buildings are diesel users. So Steve and I have talked a little bit about several years ago, the board made a policy to end the use of fossil fuels here at Holden. It's really never in a concerted way been worked at. And this year we think we might, we've bantered around the goal of cutting diesel use in half in 1 year. And I think it's obtainable. And it's very possibly obtainable. And that would be about 8,000 gallons. About 8,000 gallons. And it's about $1 a gallon. We're looking at pretty significant cost savings. Not everything goes real well. There's still a lot of things to work at. One of the problems we have here is because we live here for free, it's hard to believe that anybody's paying for the wood or paying for the diesel that we use to heat ourselves. It's unfortunate. It's like drivers in a lot of ways. If it's not your vehicle, you don't feel as responsible for it. And when you aren't paying for the diesel that's heating you, it's really hard to get you to turn it down to 65, because you get that mentality that it's all free, just like our electricity here. We use it all because we've got the water, and it's all free. But it's really hard to get folks to end that mentality. I don't know why our logic is so connected to our pocketbook, but it really is, and so that's some of the more of the community education things that we need to work on. So that's my piece.
Christopher, on packaging.
Whenever I bring something into the village, I end up feeling kind of guilty. First time I came in, I was bringing whatever belongings I brought in. I thought, well, I'm supposed to be going to be living simply up at Holden, and when you arrive, someone else is loading it onto the bus or whatever. And you know, as I've been here, I've loaded people in and out, and you kind of see how much stuff people bring. And as I bring stuff in, I always. I know I'm bringing things that are not essential, and I still seem to have these needs, and so I buy things from REI and stuff that I seem to need, but it bothers me a certain amount. So and it kind of reminds me of gifts a little bit. When you get gifts in our society, sometimes get to be old people think that they have to give gifts all the time, and they have to give you something, whether you need it or not, but they to
show love, a gift is important. So anyway, I got this box in the mail that I didn't order. It was a big box. So I was kind of intrigued, but I was also a little bit anxious because I pretty much knew it was something I didn't need. And it was from Minnesota Public Radio's kind of mail order marketing address. And I'm on their mailing list, and so I see that I get their catalogs. And so I opened it up, and it was from my folks. And mostly what it was styrofoam. So I was kind of mad. And my folks are pretty understanding, so I figured they could handle me being a jerk and not being a gracious recipient to it. My mom used to do a lot of writing, so I even figured she could kind of get into this letter I wrote to Minnesota Public Radio.
What was in the box, Chris?
Oh, it was some of this Lutheran coffee. You wrote in Minnesota or something. Two coffee mugs.
Chris's folks are Catholics.
I got married in Lutheran church, and my dad was kind of upset. They thought I needed Lutheran coffee. So this is a letter I wrote to him, and this is my contribution. Dear sir or madam, I greet you with two questions. Why would a gift package from Minnesota Public Radio sent by my parents, whom I dearly love, ruin my day? Why would the same package make me consider withdrawing support from my local NPR affiliate? Here's why. The package you sent symbolizes to me about 50% of what is wrong with American society. Literally, the box contained two coffee mugs, a sack of ordinary tasting but overpriced coffee, and four times their volume in styrofoam angel poop. Symbolically, it contained gift trinkets for nostalgic new agers packed in the tired baggage of rape and pillage societies.
Can you read that one again?
Okay. Symbolically, it contained gift trinkets for nostalgic new agers packed in the tired baggage of a rape and pillage society. If NPR was just another capitalistic exploiter of energy and waste, I could grudgingly acknowledge your ability to fleece my parents in the same way that an adversary respects the cunning of his or her enemy. But I guess I always thought of NPR as being an ally in the fight against ignorance and mediocrity. No longer, with your catalog full of new age consumer trinkets, the only difference between you and any other sleazy entrepreneur is one of style. Your casual use of obscene amounts of ozone-destroying packaging material only underscores your lack of a social conscience. In the future, I think I'll get my news from a good print media like the Christian Science Monitor. For music, I guess I'll listen to commercial rock and roll. At least they're not hypocritical. So please take back this stuff. I'm willing to pay to keep it from polluting our valley up here in the Cascades. I'm the mechanic here, and I just spent a couple days in the dump burying garbage. That styrofoam blows all over the place. Maybe you've heard of this place, Holden. It's a retreat center way up in the mountains, and we get a lot of Minnesota Lutheran types visiting or working here. And please take my wife's name off your mailing list. I'd ask to have my folks taken off your list too, but that would be ruder than sending back their gift. Even though I don't want your catalog, I'd sure like to hear a response to this action. I know I probably sound like some naive crank up in the mountains. And I shouldn't expect to change your tactics, but I'd like to hear what you're going to do about it. Why don't you use newspaper to pack worthwhile merchandise? Try to make as much difference as NPR usually does. Don't cheapen them with your crass marketing. good ends don't justify bad means.
Did you get a response?
I didn't get a response.
This was said about a month.
April 25th.
April 25th, yeah. So I have to get on him again. And I showed it to my mom, and she was really supportive because she doesn't get out a lot. And we were kind of poor when I was growing up. I don't know if this is the reason, but she buys a lot of stuff from mail order places. She buys too much stuff, and we always get on her case about it. But she realizes that it's packed in styrofoam, and I think a lot of us kind of have to think about just because someone else made the decision to pack it, we made the decision to buy it, and we're kind of complicit in it all. And I don't know if it makes much difference to write to them, but I think really in the last year or so, I've seen a lot more articles in the media, in the print media at least, pertaining to garbage and to landfills and to incineration. So I think it's going to be an issue that's going to take off. And so maybe little things that we do, sometimes it seems little things don't make a difference, but maybe at this point we're getting kind of a critical mass of concern. And maybe something as dumb as writing this letter could start to have an impact if we all start getting involved a little.
Okay, thanks. We have about 20 minutes, a little more than that, 25 minutes left, and want to take some time to brainstorm or discuss together. We could take up all the time just sort of fielding questions about Holden and what we're doing, and that's okay if people have some questions, but I think more fruitful would be if we could involve all of you sort of in discussing kinds of things you're doing in your communities and what you think on this whole issue sort of more generally also. And why don't you raise your hand, I'll call on to Katie.
Well, the thing about the styrofoam, one, it makes a real big difference that you write the letter and send it back. I have a business in Chicago and we get a lot of shipments sent to us of books and clothing, etc. And sometime, maybe 2 years ago, we started not just cursing the styrofoam that it comes wrapped in, we started mailing it back. In fact, we started even giving it to the UPS guy. We'd say, hold on, and you know how fast they move. They don't want to wait. You go, hold on, and open it up, you go, come back here at the end of your run. And we'd empty it all out, put the label right back on, and give it to them. And we made contact with all of our suppliers and said, don't send us this stuff because you're going to get it right back and we'll find someone else who has the same books and doesn't feel the need to wrap it in.
You mean they'll re-deliver it?
Yep. Yeah. If we put it in a box.
I told you about this the other night.
The other thing that...
Successful? How can that be?
Well, I don't know how it would work up here. I haven't seen a UPS truck pull up here. But I did see that you guys got Solo cups today. Are those plastic or paper?
Paper.
Wax paper. We don't have any styrofoam.
Because I was going to say, they now make paper stuff good enough to handle hot drinks. Took us a while in the restaurant, too, to find a decent... and it's more expensive, period. When you make a commitment to not use styrofoam, you are paying more money. You have to package to go stuff in paper. It's much more expensive. It's a little sloppier. But I really think that the people that talk to Holden Village could definitely hear in their orientation letter or their letter that confirms you're coming, a page, just a thing, devoted, very clear, not full of words, but very clear. Do not bring plastic containers. If you're carrying shampoo or whatever, blah, blah, that comes in a plastic container, you are expected to carry it out. I mean, really, just get them partners, get us to be partners in this with you. This is perfect, fertile ground for that, anyone who comes to Holden. And so started even before they get here to say, we're doing this major thing. And I wanted to ask Joanne, I mean, today what went on up here?
It blew my mind. what was up there. I mean, it made me feel good because I have my own garbage hole at home and it was
it's about a hundredth of the size of what. So, I mean, that made a dent, didn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, what if every week had a day like that?
That's the point of, we plan on doing that weekly all summer at least.
Because I don't think we should bury any more plastic bottles. I really don't. I mean, you could ask me, take a bag of them out with you. Of course, somebody else is gonna deal even worse with them, probably.
We had that discussion here too, like, what are the ethics of sending it
somewhere else, right?
Yeah.
It's like the barge. Garbage barge.
So one thing I should maybe brought up is,
Oh yeah, the 5 gallon buckets.
With oil, so I wonder what.
Well, the one he was describing to me, what we get our oil in from a restaurant are 5 gallon buckets with a handle on the top and a screw top.
Yeah.
We return them to the supplier. They are reusable. And if your supplier won't take them back and you're a good customer, have somebody phone around for some other prices and just act like a consumer and go, look, buddy, you won't take them back. I'll go to this guy. He will take them back. Or, you know, whatever. The other thing is that you could sell them to co-ops or, you know, do some kind of trade on that, because except for mixing oil and honey, which you can't do, you know, oil things can be refilled again with oil, and honey things can too. And we do that. I know you probably grow your own sprouts here. I haven't seen sprouts, but when you do, like, we return our sprout things, trays too. I'm a fellow on the road of trying to get less, and believe me, we still make a lot.
Steve had been in Chelan recently, talked with a restaurant owner who wished, what'd she say? Wish she could get some non-styrofoam sources.
That's kind of a strange day. I was in Wenatchee calling about some of this recycling, trying to get some, line up some stuff, and I was coming back to a race and trying to get into the road before noon, the new enclosure. But I stopped at this fast food place. I hate stopping at fast food places, but I stopped at this place and I asked them if they were handing out stuff in styrofoam containers, and I asked the woman if she could give me, I would buy some food if she could package in paper. I wasn't about to carry styrofoam out of there. And she said, yeah, we can do that. And she said she didn't just sit there and talking for a while with her about styrofoam. She's been trying to find paper packaging. It was like, even sometimes things as simple as that, it's amazing because the impact you can have. Because we just haven't talked about it for a while, and I got the impression from leaving that she really was going to look that much harder to get something besides styrofoam.
Right.
It was just an oddball experience. And really, I guess I got a lot of energy from just that, because the discussion, but.
I don't know how many of you shopped at Safeway and they have a choice of either plastic or paper, and for goodness sakes, don't ask for plastic, even if it's more convenient to carry. So that's one place we can, because if there's if the demand for plastic goes up, well, sure, that they tried to convert to all plastic, but it didn't sit too well. So that's.
Do you want to say anything about the composting?
Well, if anybody wants to ask about it, I think it's very important. I bought a home in Pleasant Hill, California in 1960, and I made the commitment that not a leaf, not a twig, nor any garbage would leave the place. About 2 years after I bought it, there was a leak and down into the electric motor driving the disposal, so I took it up, threw it away, and put a 5 gallon bucket under the sink. My good wife agreed to put all the garbage, kitchen garbage, in that, and all of that went through the composting operation. So for 28 years, we have recycled everything we produced back into the soil. Our soil is now about a foot higher than
it's rich. Ooh, I bet it's rich.
I've got tomato plants that are reached 5 foot and starting to go over the top, and that's on a road bed. It used to be an easement to adobe house down the street. So you can convert sticky adobe clay into good soil if you take the time. But for goodness sakes, don't put sand in before you get the organic matter in. And so when I came up here, they were going to do tumble drum type of composting. And I made comparisons between that and the system that I've been using for about 10 years. And I found that the tumble drums tended to cool down too much. They made mud balls out of your garbage and a few other things. So we went ahead and put six bins in. If they're run right, they'll do a good job. There are certain basics that have to be followed. You have to have proper air, proper moisture, and a proper combination of compostables, the high nitrogen, low nitrogen materials. So.
I may add, Russ and Madeline were named by Organic Gardener magazine back in 1984, was it?
83.
The Organic Gardeners of the Year.
Look at the 1984 February issue. We're on the cover.
Barb, I just want to follow up too, just one more quick comment too on what was said about the bags at the grocery store. And I know, you know, sometimes people can feel real tacky because I've tried it, and sometimes I feel a little tacky, but I just got in the habit in L.A. grocery bags too, back to the grocery store. And especially if I did get plastic, because they were convenient, I would just reuse those same plastic ones, and all the time I'd grab myself a handful and then just stick them in my cart as soon as I got to the store, and then just use those again. And sometimes people will look at you, but actually that can be kind of an educational opportunity too for others, you know, for people to see that, you know, instead of piling up your bags in your closet this deep, to just reuse them.
Two things. Just one thing on top of that is that I was in a Safeway for the first time where they even asked. In Chicago, they don't ask. They automatically put your stuff in plastic. And so I would say to people who come from places where you don't have at least the opportunity that the person asked you to say, yo, paper. You know, I mean, because otherwise they'll just do it. But what I wanted to say, just sort of put this in some perspective, which is something that I did this semester with my students on Urban Studies, is we looked at solid waste management in Chicago, which is, we're talking about it here, we're talking about, gigantic. And we discovered a couple of things, and it's just, I just want to give you some of these numbers so that you can think well on them. In the landfill that takes most of Chicago's garbage, they get per day over a ton of disposable razors. They get over 10 tons of disposable diapers. And they get something like half a ton of disposable pens and lighters. Let's all start thinking about that in your daily life back at home, about how we've turned it into a disposable culture and how we use. Holden, I'm sorry, has Gillette disposable razors in the store. Okay? Zippo lighters, folks, they went through World War II, you know, and things like that. Thinking about those things. So that it was a real kind of wonderful experience, because I wasn't sure how, you know, college students in an urban setting would react to, okay, we're going to spend 3 weeks looking at Chicago's garbage, folks. And just to sort of say that the thing that, you know, to resonate with whoever said it was you, Chris, that there's things are appearing in the media and it's almost the 100th monkey on this issue, you know. Students were just talked about it constantly. Once they saw it, once I took them out to the dump and showed them the dump, you know, and we went around and we looked at where Chicago puts its garbage in, the one neighborhood that Chicago dumps all its garbage on, and the condition that that neighborhood's in. And it's just like going up to the tailings and looking. I would just implore people to go back home and just check what
what does your community do with its garbage? And to go look at it, you know? Or maybe once just open up your own garbage can before you throw it away and go, you know, take a good look at it, because it's a real scary thing.
That's a good point, because I work in a suburb of the Twin Cities, and right outside my office on the other side of the railroad tracks is this huge landfill. I mean, this is like, I do a lot of skiing, this is like a hill you could ski down. I mean, it's incredible. I see these garbage trucks I don't look out my window all the time, I do get some work done, but I see these garbage trucks going in and out every now and then, and I just think, my gosh, I mean, I've never been that close to, like you say, all the garbage that is disposed of. It's a real eye-opener.
Dan and then Gloria.
I've been helping out with the logging project these last few weeks, and last Thursday, two guys from the Forest Service came up, and Holden's firewood policy is basically we take down trees, windfall trees, and then live or dead standing trees for our firewood. We take about 100 cords, which comes out to about 100 trees that we need to get out of this valley in our firewood. We've changed our policy a little bit, and we're going to take 150 cords this year, 50 cords of which are going to come from live standing trees. So we had two guys come up from the Forest Service to mark timber for us, and I was the one that spent the day with them looking at aerial photos of the valley, talking about the timber management plan for the Railroad Creek. And the day turned out to be quite a revelation for me, because something really kind of profound came out of that. When the one timber guy out of Chelan said that there's a possibility that Holden Village will have to get its firewood from another valley in 10 years. Couple things. One, as Barry mentioned, the area that's crowding closer and closer. Mm-hmm. Not crowding, but it's growing. But also, the valley floor is limited in the amount of timber. This place was harvested commercially in the 60s with some large timber operations. And it was kind of the first time that I've ever taken a look at also the wood consumption that we use here in the village. And that for me became kind of alarming, because I'm as we move away from fossil fuels and relying more heavily on wood, we're going to be using more wood. This Forest Service person in particular was saying that it's going to come a time when we will have exhausted the available wood source in the valley floor in Railroad Creek. And so that's just something I thought I'd add. But it was really, really significant.
Gloria.
Two things. How is Holden's recycling the glass? And the second thing, what is the hydroelectric power situation? Did they were going to do something, enhancement of it a couple of years ago. Did they do it, or?
Well, when I arrived, they were talking about, they had completed a study of different options for producing more hydroelectric power. And they had sorted it down to one option, which was to put in replace one of our two generators with a more efficient generator, basically a lighter one. And then also another phase of that would be to make a larger diversion dam, or more of a storage dam up where the diversion dam is up in Railroad Creek. When I arrived, I think they were talking $250,000 was the estimate for that. The guy who was doing, Bob Edwards, is doing the electrician and hydro job at the time. And I used to help him out sometimes. I got really kind of an affection for the generators that we have, because I'm not sure exactly how old they are, but the patents on them go back to previous century.
And 1910s.
Yeah, there's one built. On one of them, it's 1896, the patent. One of the patents.
I mean, when they were built, it was
1910.
Yeah.
And, I know, being a mechanic here, I haven't seen any piece of machinery around here that's as reliable as those generators are. And it kind of amazed me at the time. I think they were talking about an increase of maybe 25% was the largest estimate that I heard. An increase of 25%, and maybe an average winter in before we get, there's kind of a curve. We have more power at the beginning, and as the water decreases to maybe March or the end of February, it gets less and less. We start out the winter around maybe 100 kilowatt capacity, and well, this winter we got as low as 27 kilowatts.
Which is 27,000 watts, so like a 100 watt light bulb.
Yeah.
You can only run 270 of them.
Yeah.
It's like a hair dryer sometimes can consume from 1,000 to 1,500. The big ones can consume 2,000 watts. We're only producing 27.
But the weather don't bring hair dryers.
But so even 25% of that small amount is not a very big increase, particularly when you weigh it against the cost. And then as time went on, and the estimate kept going up higher, and it started approaching a half million, and that pretty much put that aside. I thought that was not really justified for the winter community. You know, for a winter community, and I feel like more like measures that Steve Kirk had been working on conservation. You know, developing, educating people about comfort zones. So does that answer your question?
I think, can I add something to that? One of the other, evidently, resistances to that whole thing, I wasn't here then, but my understanding is that there was some concern already raised by environmental groups about adding, for one of those options of adding
the seven mile.
Yeah. And, building a new generator.
Building a new generator, and it looked like that could have been brought to a full kind of battle, which I frankly would have probably been on the side of the other side. The other thing that some of you may know about this than I do, but I know that some of we've had some engineers up here and some of the electricians have talked about what's called a power factor, and that our system is not particularly efficient in getting the power from the generator to the village, and that there are ways that we can increase the power that we get with a lot less money, although it would still be pretty expensive. A lot of it would be replacing some of the wiring and some of the sort of transfer system between the generators and the village. And that's been looked into too.
And one of the others is power management, which Holden really hasn't done. This winter we installed timers on all of our hot water heaters, and basically people were getting, in the dead of winter, one tank of water a day, one tank of hot water, and after that you didn't have any unless you walked to a building that was heating that water by diesel or by wood. We can do a lot more in power management. Even though 27 kilowatts isn't a lot of power, that's plenty. We also have to make choices. We live in the backcountry. I don't know that we deserve or can demand hot water all the time, or electric heat, and that's part of the deal in living here.
Did somebody want to say something about glass too? I know the high school kids last spring took out a lot of glass. The interior record organized that. And what's the plan?
We're going to try to recycle all that glass. We have two options with the glass. Either we could pay the barge to ship the glass out, because the glass isn't worth anything to anyone, I guess, as far as money-wise. They won't pay us money to take the glass. There's basically Wenatchee, supervised skills. It's like a sheltered workshop that will take the glass on a free basis. They'll take it. So we either we'll ship it out on the barge and have someone take it like in a truck to this place, or we will try to give it to guests as we accumulate glass. We'll try to break it into and we would smash it in boxes and mark it like with the place in Wenatchee, and if people carry that glass out with them then on the boat, hopefully it'll work out that way. See what comes out.
So have you actually put that into effect yet?
We're saving an impression that we haven't actually shipped any out yet. We've kind of started the last 3 weeks, 2 weeks.
How much will the barge company charge?
The barge is about 2.5 cents a pound, I think, isn't it? Is that right? Which they'll probably go down on that price for stuff like salvage stuff. We're going to deal with the barge to take like a scrap iron is worth a penny a pound in Chelan at the dock. So they'll take out that scrap metal for a penny a pound. So they'll in fact get the money from what the metal's worth. So we won't make any money on it. We also won't lose any on it. All we lose is just the effort we spend and the transportation to the lake. Some things are worth money. Some things are worth nothing. At Chelan, like the tin is not worth anything. It'll be picked up. It's not worth anything. So we might have to subsidize the barge to get rid of that kind of stuff. Along with glass, be the same way. Glass would even be worse in a way because glass won't be picked up at Chelan. It would bring to Wenatchee and then to give it away. So it's kind of an effort just getting this stuff out. We have $1,200 budgeted, I guess. The board budgeted $1,200 though for recycling and third level cleanup. So we actually, with that amount of money, we can I think pretty easily completely clean the third level of all the metal recyclables.
There's also building. Some money from the last recycling, which yeah. We mostly eliminated that, so we actually made money on that.
Okay, well, thanks everybody. I know there's still some other questions and you can feel free to talk informally if you'd like to. These guys are available to you to talk throughout the day's week here.
Just blowing you
down. That's gorgeous. Yeah. Anyway, thanks. I'd like to hear from some of you too what you're doing in your communities. But anyway, we like to formally end after an hour so that everybody can leave who wants to. And then if someone wants to stay around,